Well, good afternoon, and let me begin by saying that the first time I ever stood before a congregation to preach, I had no business doing so. I was 14 years old, and it was actually at a state Sunday school convention in central Pennsylvania. My father said to me the following words: "Son, there's two things you got to remember about preaching." And I thought he'd give me some high and lofty directive about keeping Christ at the center, or making sure that the point of the sermon was the point of the biblical passage. And this is what he said: "Number one, the brain can only contain what the bottom can endure. And if you can't strike oil in a half an hour or less, quit boring people." So I know that you've all been sitting on your bottoms for a very long time today, but I just want to thank Dr. Woodbridge for that magnificent address, and Dr. Mao before. At lunchtime, we were all sitting around the speaker's desk. Here we have Richard Mao, Al Mohler, Timothy George, David Dockery, Paul House, John Woodbridge, and Russell Moore. And I said, this is like the Evangelical Avengers. I think this was a remarkable gathering. I think Matt Hall was there as Agent Phil Coulson. So it really was a privilege to be a part of this program today. And I'm not going to talk to you about my book, although I'm going to be very optimistic in thinking that, pointing you to some of that. But I want to talk to you about, like a record, these are some of the outtakes of things that I would have liked to have gone into more detail in the book. And I want to talk about the issue of Carl Henry's scholarship and the importance that he placed upon philosophical understanding and discourse in his written corpus. I do think that this celebration of Carl Henry is something of an irony. On the one hand, Carl Henry was such a humble man, and we've heard about that today. He was also a very modest man. Back in 1997, Paul House, myself, Ben Mitchell, Richard Bailey, and I were talking in the Southern Baptist Journal of Theology conference, and Paul House said, "I wonder if Dr. Henry would be interested in republishing God, Revelation, and Authority." And we went down and talked to Dr. Mohler about it. And this began a series of pilgrimages on the part of some of us to Watertown, Wisconsin, to visit with Carl and Helga on 1141 Huss Drive in Watertown, Wisconsin. I'm not making that up. He lived on Jan Huss Drive in Watertown, Wisconsin. And he lived in a very modest apartment. As many of you know, he gave a significant gift to Trinity Evangelical Divinity School when he died. He was a very humble man, and we saw that on display being entertained in his home. I talked to Marvin Alasky a couple weeks ago. He had read my book and called me and wanted to talk about it. And he told me a remarkable story that I think is illustrative of why there's a bit of irony that we're celebrating Carl Henry today with the kind of man that he was. As many of you know, Carl Henry began writing op-ed columns for World Magazine, and Marvin Alasky said that every couple of weeks, Carl Henry wrote everything that he ever wrote on this old banged-up typewriter, and he said every couple of weeks, and it was sitting there. I would really like to know what happened to that typewriter. But he would every couple of weeks get a 3-page article from Carl F.H. Henry in the mail. And in the envelope, there was a self-addressed stamped postcard back to Watertown, Wisconsin, with the article that had written by Carl in his own hand, "Accept or Reject." So every article he ever sent to World Magazine, he wanted to know if Marvin liked it or didn't like it. He did not presume that because he was Carl Henry, his article would get published. Now, Marvin always sent back "accept" and put it back in the mail, but Carl Henry wanted feedback. He wanted to grow as a writer and as a scholar, which I think is an amazing testimony to his humility. And it is a great privilege to be here, because I'm just very ambitious for us to be doing this, because Carl Henry would have loved to have seen this. he was dispirited at times, I think, that his work had not achieved maybe the popularity that he would have liked to have seen during his time. God, Revelation, and Authority never appeared as a set. But he said several times to many of us who were with him that in a previous generation, Albrecht Ritschl's work was not approved and taken up until the generation after. So he sort of left it up to us to do it, and that's what we're about here doing today. Now, for the next few moments that we have together, I would like to focus on a very narrow slice of what Carl Henry was about. And it's a theme that I talk about in my little volume on him. Carl Henry held several academic posts throughout his career, but whenever he did, he flew under the banner of philosopher. It's a discipline that he cared so deeply about that he went back to graduate school to Boston University so that he could get a second PhD in the field, where he wrote his dissertation about personal idealism and A.H. Strong's theology as an outworking of the influences of Borden Parker Bowne. In the interviews that I've given over the last couple of months on the Henry legacy, I always point out that there's a personal indebtedness to me in all of this. I went through something of a dark night of the soul when I was in college. I was under the sway of a very articulate Oxford-trained biblical studies professor who was giving me a very high dose of higher criticism when I was in college. And it was something very close to a Bart Ehrman scenario for me. And I came very close to going to the dark side. And my godly father, who is a faithful pastor and a scholar in his own right, said, find Carl Henry and his volumes in your library and read them before you give up the faith. So I remember walking down that long staircase at my college, down on the floor in the stacks, pulling out God, Revelation, Authority, and Carl Henry started pulling me back in. But the reason why he pulled me back in was because he was doing more than just tit for tat responding to why the Bible is historically reliable. He did that. But he went one further. He had philosophical gravitas in God, Revelation, and Authority. His focus was not narrow. He encompassed epistemological concerns, which were my primary concerns as an undergraduate student studying philosophy. So I came within a whisker of losing my faith, and it was because Carl Henry was a philosopher defending biblical authority that he pulled me back. Now, I went on to Union University. I primarily taught philosophy there, but I've also taught my fair share of seminary courses along the way, too. And inevitably, when I teach a course in philosophy in a seminary setting, I get that inevitable question, well, didn't the Apostle Paul tell us to beware of philosophy? I always, no matter where I teach, I always get that question. And my response is always that it's the adjective that is all important in Paul's admonition to the Colossians. Paul admonishes the Colossians to beware of vain philosophy, things that are based upon the principles, elementary principles of the world rather than according to Christ. Now, for a while, I thought that this bias was limited to people who are, you know, maybe a few ministry candidates here and there. But I think that this sentiment is shared more broadly. The proof of the pudding is in the eating thereof. And I'll give a rather granular example of this that is recent enough that maybe some of you will connect with this. Since I'm in Louisville, I'll give a Louisville example of this. Does anybody remember the talk that R.C. Sproul gave at the 2010 Together for the Gospel conference? Okay, I remember talking to people after, okay, there's a couple of nods of recognition. I remember talking, I wasn't personally there, I went and listened to it later because of what I was told, but people said, yeah, I mean, there were all these great talks, and then R.C. Sproul got up and spent the whole time talking about the importance of Hegelian philosophy, and I had no idea what he was talking about. I just kind of zoned out at that point. Well, I think there you go. That is a very similar kind of scenario. But R.C. Sproul understood what Carl Henry understood, and it's something that we need to learn in evangelical ministry preparation. to understand philosophical movements in our time is the new pre-evangelism. That is pre-evangelism, is to understand philosophy. So when Slavoj Žižek, the apoplectic Slovenian philosopher, who is today every bit as recognizable on the world stage as Bertrand Russell was in the mid-20th century, when Žižek talks, legions of young people listen. And when they listen to his lectures, his Intelligence Squared talks, his appearances in books and films, what's he talking about? He's talking about the same thing R.C. Sproul was talking about. He's talking about the same thing Carl Henry was talking about, which is Hegelian philosophy. Last year, his magnum opus, the 1,200-page Less Than Nothing, is about Hegel. It's about Lacan. It's about Alain Badiou. And Žižek revels in this Hegelian notion that what history is a total fabrication. It's our way of compensating for the fact that what reality really is less than nothing. It is a series of meaningless accidents that we try to attach a narrative to. So if we want to reach this generation for the gospel, and we're frustrated because young intellectuals are cynical and hard to reach, we need to ask ourselves the question, how many of us, to follow up to Dr. Woodbridge's lecture on Carl Henry's evangelistic impulse, how many of us love them enough to read the text that they read, not only to dismiss them, to cherry-pick them for the things that we think are wrong with them and then dismiss them out of hand, but to really have a conversation with them. That is what Carl F.H. Henry did. So we have these conferences that we put on that are long on Bible exposition, that contend admirably for orthodoxy, but are largely silent on the great ideologies that grip the hearts of those whom we are most desperately trying to reach in our culture today. Now, let me give a case in point on this. Several weeks ago, my wife and I, over the summer, the announcement for the King's College happened, and it was almost sort of in Jackson, Tennessee, it was kind of like a highly selective rapture for, theologians named Thornbury. And we kind of left under cover of darkness. We had to move very quickly. So we finally got a chance to go back and say goodbye to everybody at Union. And one of the most moving parts of that, David Dockery threw us a magnificent dinner. And they presented to me a framed copy of this edition of Christianity Today from May 9th, 1960, in which Carl Henry's lead editorial is Why We Need a Christian University in New York City. Now, it moved me to tears at the moment, but then they got me an actual copy of Christianity Today from that particular episode, and I'd read it a number of times, but I reread Henry's editorial, and he's talking about denominational colleges that had gone adrift. Now, this is 1960s, folks. This is 1960, and he's talking about Christian colleges that are adrift. And here's what he says, quote, "Even church colleges have a disappointing history. Many have lost their early Christian vision, and evangelical conviction often struggles for expression and even survival on campuses to which it once imparted life. Among approximately 600 of the 750 liberal arts colleges in the United States that are church-related, some have not attained high academic ideals, but many more neglect the implications of the Christian faith. The founders had a great vision. Churchmen and laymen have given sacrificial support. The campus has a great beginning in tradition. But often when professors in these same schools close classroom doors to lecture, they resurrect Aristotle, Hegel, Darwin, Dewey, Kant, and Kierkegaard, only to leave Jesus Christ hanging on a cross, unrecognized and unwanted." Now, what is Henry saying here? The Academy cares about ideas. The Academy cares about philosophy. And here we are. We're sending our young ones. We train them up at church, and then we send them out to these, you know, in many cases, secular universities or other colleges and universities that are adrift. And I think it's akin, at least spiritually speaking, to the Canaanites sacrificing their children to Moloch, because this is what is happening. It is pure, undiluted ideology. Now, in this same copy of Christianity Today that Carl Henry wrote this article on the need for a great Christian university in New York, this is what's in the rest of the issue. The next article is by Gordon Clark. This is Christianity Today. And there's an article on philosophy in the 1960s in which Gordon Clark talks about instrumentalism, John Dewey, existentialism, and logical positivism, and their influence in contemporary culture. The next article is by Dirk Jellema of what is now Case Western University, talking about the rise of the postmodern mind, 1960. Here, Jellema's charts social theories move away from a patterned reality concept of the world. That was Christianity Today, folks, in 1960s. Three or four of the articles in that issue had to do with the importance of philosophy. Henry and his pals were less concerned with internecine evangelical squabbles than they were with the world of ideas that competed with the Christian truth claim. And we need to get back to that, is what I'm trying to say today. In a book that Henry edited in 1978 called Horizons of Science, Henry's bio, which we all know, embarrassingly, we all write our own bios, right? I mean, nobody else is out there writing the bios for us. We write them ourselves. You know, we're speaking in the voice of Bob Dole. It's the third person reference to ourselves, you know, when all of these things happen. And here's how Henry describes himself in his bio. He describes himself as a scholar who maintains a keen interest in the reconciliation of theology, philosophy, and science. And that's who he was, to his core, as a scholar. I think some of that same elan would do us some good again. So now, we've talked a lot about the uneasy conscience of modern fundamentalism in this conference, and for good reason. But there was a book before, an important book before The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism in 1946 called Remaking the Modern Mind. In it, Henry contends for a new philosophical literacy that must be the mandate for the new evangelicalism. We have to remember that the order, Henry said, is important. He does Remaking the Modern Mind first and then follows it up with The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism. He covers the entire history of philosophy in the West. He does that first before he moves to socio-political critique. In it, he traces the influence of the pre-Socratic philosophers, Plato and Aristotle, Spinoza and Hume, on the West thinking about the uniformity of nature and the possibility of theism, while juxtaposing them to the concepts in the Hebrew-Christian revelatory pattern. He considers the impact of Kantian and Hegelian idealism on Western history, alongside close readings of Nikolai Berdyaev, Reinhold Niebuhr, Etienne Gilson, and Paul Tillich. Despite later characterizations of Henry as some sort of hopeless rationalist, he subjects Descartes to withering critique in Remaking the Modern Mind. Later on in the book, he talks about the influence of Henri Bergson and Samuel Alexander, decades before anybody thought it might be cool to revise the doctrine of God along the lines of process theism. Henry's talking about this stuff in 1946. Now, maybe people weren't reading it, but he was talking about it. This kind of work paved the way for an entire generation of philosophically informed theologians. It's impossible to imagine people like Norm Geisler and E.J. Carnell, Colin Brown and Millard Erickson without Henry, and the people who inspired Henry, Gordon Clark, William Yelema and Cornelius Van Til as precursors. The same thing is doubly true for Francis Schaeffer, who borrowed liberally from all of these without giving attribution. In sum, Henry understood that the greatest threat to evangelization, if I say any one thing, this is it that I want you to get. The greatest threat to world evangelization was ideology. Consider his final paragraph in Remaking the Modern Mind. The modern ideology needs to be remade. That is admitted today by those who have shaped it as well as those who have opposed it. But its effective remaking can only be accomplished in a philosophical framework in which rebirth is something more than a change of human temperament, in which indeed it is a divine reversal, a work of regeneration. If the modern mind is not reborn, but merely exchanges one mood for another, we stand only one generation away from the fruit of atheism, the pessimism of despair. End of book. Now that's a prophetic word. And all God's people said, now, in the weeks and months after I've written this book on applying Carl Henry's thought to current theological problems, people have asked, "What if you had learned one thing from Carl Henry, what was it?" And I say inevitably this, that there is a difference between the gospel and ideology. To me, that is the main contribution that Carl Henry made. It's that the gospel is the one transcendent, ahistorical, never-changing truth claim. It encompasses every culture and is yet not bound to any one ideology or culture. Henry's work believed that there was no other viable option for Western culture other than biblical theism. He thought that it was impossible to outflank the genius of Christianity, that there was no other viable alternative. His confidence in the gospel and the creed was not just a leap of faith. It wasn't sheer will to power. It was a rational conclusion that was based upon careful analysis. And so there was a fascinating moment in his follow-up. Now, what was the follow-up to The Uneasy Conscience of Modern Fundamentalism? It was a book called The Protestant Dilemma, in which he reflects upon the key moment that the neo-evangelical movement faces as the West emerges from the post-World War II environment. And he sees, again, an opening for a new philosophical point of view. And it's very interesting in what he does at this point. And I would like to cite, I actually am one of those few people that thinks that much of Carl Henry's prose is just absolutely riveting. There are other parts of it that are admittedly, as Donald Rumsfeld said about the Iraq War, a long, hard slog. But Henry has these moments of truly poetic prose. But he talks in The Protestant Dilemma about a key turning point similar to the post-World War II environment in Plato's Republic. Listen to what he says here. A similar longing to that of our culture is found at a high point in Plato's Republic. The great Greek thinker, foreseeing that the prevailing moral instability would lead to the downfall of the nation, urges his contemporaries to become explicit about the spiritual moral universe. Plato then proposes an outline for an ideal state which will function with reference to an eternal good, an eternal truth, and an eternal beauty. At this point, a very practical question arises. How are the multitudes to be prevailed upon to undertake the change from the old world in order to receive the new? What compelling sanction can be appealed to that people will dedicate themselves to their proper roles? And Plato's answer to this, as Henry points out, citing Plato, is we must devise one grand royal lie. At which point he talks about the tiered structure of the philosopher king, and then the military class, and then the servant class. And we're going to frame this by making this an appeal to God, Plato says. God proclaims the first principles to the rulers, and above all else, they should anxiously guard it. And then we have the guardians, and then we have the people that support the state. And here's Plato's words. Such is our tale. Is there any chance of making our citizens believe it? At which Henry continues. For all of its brilliance, there is no more pathetic moment in Plato's Republic. For here Plato, who would have been the last to concede that an eternal spiritual moral realm was merely a postulation of his own mind, would nonetheless ride the conviction into the hearts of the multitudes by anchoring it to pure mythology, unquote. What Henry objects to here is this, that if the best case scenario is Plato, of all the pagan philosophers, Plato's the best, right? I mean, this is what Justin Martyr told us, right? I mean, Origen and Clement of Alexandria, these guys are all on board, right? And yet, at the end of the day, all he is able to offer to his culture is actually something deeply cynical. It's something that if Zizek were reading this, he'd say, this is just pure ideology. It's right there in the text. We don't really think that there's this divine order, but we're going to tell them this in order to shape a new republic. It's a just-so tale devised to control the polis. That's the way a Marxist would read it. Henry's confidence in the gospel and his belief in biblical theism is a conclusion at the end of philosophical searching. Although Henry loved to tell his testimony of how he came to faith in the risen Lord Jesus, his mien as an evangelical scholar came from his being a philosopher. If God does not disclose himself in intelligent sentences and paragraphs, Henry said, the universe loses color and hue. We are left to the gray scale of pure ideology. And this is what he wanted out of the American evangelical moment. And so when he wrote this massive six-volume, God, Revelation, and Authority, when you pick it up and actually read it, and here again, I'm going to, you know, this may be like an absurd existentialist enterprise that I am going to get people to actually read God, Revelation, and Authority again. I want them to, you know, even if I have to sit down personally with them and read it out loud, we're going to do this. When you actually read God, Revelation, and Authority, what you appreciate is the breadth of Henry's scholarship. There is biblical studies, there's contemporary theology, there's sociology, there's psychology, there's history, there's politics, all represented in his research. And he was interested in trying to bring the disciplines together. He headed up IFACS, which was to coordinate interdisciplinary conversations. He modeled for us what to read, how to read, and why. But perhaps the most important aspect of this modeling was that he was interested in a critical reading of these philosophical texts. And perhaps the most important thing about the way Henry read these texts is that he taught us that it is not only okay, but it is actually incumbent upon us to say at key points this word to the philosophers. No. It is okay to say no. It's okay to, after you've considered the whole matter, we can say no. Now, this is a discipline I think evangelicals have forgotten. Because theology cannot begin like a junior high episode of, we really hope they like us. I want to think they like us. That's the way a lot of evangelical theology is done today, where we really hope that we can find some support for our ideas in somebody who will never like us. You know, I say this in my book. Someone asked me to define what evangelicalism was, and I said, I'll tell you. This is what it means. Anything you can do, we can do later. We can do anything later than you. So in other words, we take up with, say, French phenomenology just as it gets past its sell-by date in the Academy. That's when we think it's really sexy. When it's gone out of fashion everywhere else, hey, this will be a really good idea. We love to do this kind of stuff. But what we often won't listen to is the very people that we cite for support for our theological positions. These self-same philosophers and intellectuals, in most circumstances, and I talk about this in my book, would have an aneurysm if they thought we were appropriating them for these purposes. We pay lip service to authorial intent when it comes to biblical texts, but we seem unwilling to extend that same grace to the philosophers that we cite. Now, I mean, I could give examples of this, but here I would adduce C.S. Lewis as support in this connection, in which he said in Time magazine in May of 1955, "Christians and pagans have more in common with one another than Christians have in common with the post-Christian mind." And Chesterton said these same kinds of things. So Henry was happy to be contra mundum in response to the philosophers. He was willing to take philosophers at their word. If a theorist claimed that his position was alien to the Hebrew Christian conception of the world, Henry believed them. He would not try to shoehorn them in. This conviction stemmed from the fact that the author of God Revelation Authority believed that the great theological horse race of our time was in hermeneutics. That's why the two biggest volumes of God Revelation and Authority are on this subject. Now, maybe in my opinion, I'm weird, so I will go ahead and admit that. To me, the most fascinating chapter in all of God, Revelation, and Authority is chapter 13 of volume 3, in which you have Henry adjudicating a conversation between Schleiermacher, Dilthey, Heidegger, von Harnack, Barth, Bultmann, and Gadamer. I'm in my happy place when I'm reading that chapter. Here we find Henry gently agreeing with Karl Barth on many things. We often think that Henry was just like, dismiss Barth. He didn't. He agrees with Barth versus Harnack on this. He agrees with Gadamer's concept of veritatis, prejudice. Our own presuppositions prevent us from reading texts accurately and well. So he can say both yes and no to contemporary philosophers. But at the end of the day, as he's talking about Gadamer's truth and method, he's unwilling to accept Gadamer's conclusion on the basis of this concept that we bring sinful prejudices to our texts as we read them, that we cannot develop an imaginative sympathy with the world of the author. And so he gently works through with Gadamer. You have these concepts of tradition and of repetition and horizon fusion. You don't have to say then, on the basis of that, that the only meaning of a text is the meaning for today. It can be, again, as we heard from before, it can be the meaning of a text yesterday, today, and forever. Henry is optimistic in his outlook. He models those cardinal virtues of an evangelical scholar for us in this way. He keeps himself abreast of these philosophical conversations. And by the way, just so I'm clear here, Henry would not want this to be the province of only hoary-headed academics and scholars. He wanted this to be something that pastors and church leaders and laymen could do well too. This is not just the province of a few. This is the ministry of the church to engage in this way. I once asked Carl Henry what he would put into a seminary curriculum that was not there. He said, 2 semesters of history of philosophy and a course on logic. Now, you name me one seminary that has that in the core curriculum, and I'll give you this copy of Christianity Today. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not going to do that. I lied there. Okay. So Henry has cultivated this mantle of knowing when to say yes and knowing when to say no. Sometimes he says, let's party with this idea. He's happy to give ground to philosophical ideas where they connect with biblical theism. But he's also willing to say, we can't dance with this. We won't party with this. He had a keen sense for what was ephemeral and vain and vacuous, light or cynical or ideological. In sum, Carl Henry was characterized by wisdom in his scholarship. And he encouraged people in ministry, engage with this material. I promise you, your head will not explode. You can do this. Now I'm going to do the most maybe ridiculous thing that has happened at this conference. I'm going to compare Carl F. H. Henry to John Lennon. When John Lennon, he was at his lowest point when he met Yoko Ono. He went to a gallery exhibit, and when he met Yoko, he saw one of her expositions was a ladder going up to the ceiling. And at the top of the ceiling, there was this little latch door that you opened up. And he climbed up to that and opened the latch, and there was a message that said, yes. And John Lennon just loved that, because everything in his life up until that point had been a no. Everything had been no. Everything had been dark. But here was Yoko saying yes. So as John got down the ladder and started saying yes to Yoko Ono, he had to say no to a lot of other things, including the Beatles, including other women. This is essentially the same point that Carl Henry makes to us. We say yes to the gospel. We say yes to this great image of the bridegroom of the Lamb. We put our story into that story. But we're also happy to say no to things that threaten that story. And Carl Henry, long before there was such a thing as Fox News, was fair, balanced, and unafraid. So unlike a lot of his heirs, Carl Henry was not afraid to go to Yale and debate with Hans Frey on the issue of narrative theology. He didn't ask Hans Frey to come to the Evangelical Theological Society or convene something that was on safe territory. He went to Yale and talked. And by the way, they have just made, TEDS is going to make available the full audio of that Hans Frey Carl Henry interchange. Okay, so I think I want to say, as a part of this legacy, that gentleman who we're honoring in this conference carried a very impressive philosophical gravitas, and it was the combination of those two things, the head and the heart, that made Carl Henry the man who we are honoring here today. And I want to end with this one story that comes from an episode on this campus. I was participating in a theological studies colloquium on contemporary theology, and Carl F. H. Henry came. It was the beginning of the Henry Institute here, and he spoke on a number of different occasions. And by the way, I don't think I've told this story in public before, but when I picked up Dr. Henry at the airport at Dr. Moeller's request, I asked him where he wanted to go to dinner, and he said, Cracker Barrel. So that's where I took him. I thought Dr. Moeller was going to have a heart attack when he found out that I took Carl Henry to Cracker Barrel as his first meal in Louisville. But he got on campus here, and he was mingling with the students, and we had a meeting at lunch with the Contemporary Theology Seminar. And Andy Davis, who's now pastor of First Baptist Church in Durham, North Carolina, asked Carl Henry this question. We were talking about Pannenberg's New Systematic Theology, and Henry had read that closely as well. And Andy Davis had this question. He said, Dr. Henry, what do you consider to be the most pressing question in modern theology? And he didn't bat an eye. He said, have you met the risen Lord? That was his answer to the question. So here's this man with all this learning that could immediately turn into the evangelist that we heard about in the last hour. May the same be true of each one of us in this room studying for ministry. Thank you very much.